Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum. Celebrate the opening of I Saw It, Francisco de Goya Printmaker, with an evening of live music, art making, live model drawing, tours, and more. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. Info at nortonsimon.org.
What we learned investigating the death of Chicano student activist Oscar Gomez.
It sounds like you ran almost every theory to its end.
Binge all 8 episodes of Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us, along with critics Wade Major of Synagogues.com and Claudia Puig, the president of the LA Film Critics Association and program director for the Santa Barbara International Film Festival. We begin with the adaptation of Judy Blume's 1970 book, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Rachel McAdams stars. Claudia, what did you think of Are You There, God?
I really enjoyed this. This is a very winning and charming coming-of-age tale. It's told with humor and sweetness and intelligence. We've certainly seen a lot of coming-of-age tales, but this one, of course, is based on the Judy Blume classic. And it's very affectionate, and it's a sharp-eyed look at adolescence. It's interesting because I went to the premiere, and I had just read the book, and I was kind of underwhelmed by the book. Frankly, I'd not read it before, and I was kind of like, this is sort of dated, and didn't feel that fresh to me. And Judy Blume was at the premiere, and she said, I'm going to say something no writer has ever said. The movie is better than my book.
Wow.
Yeah. And she's absolutely right. Where the little bits that feel dated, because it's written 53 years ago, it comes alive. And there, something that the writer-director did in her adaptation, Kelly Freeman Craig, was just make it feel more, even though it's very much of its time, it also has a currency. And it really, really works. I mean, Blume is a national treasure. I actually stayed up last night and watched the documentary about her.
Which came out last week.
Yes, yeah. Which is great. I urge everyone to see that, too. She's the most banned children's book writer.
Wears that with pride.
Yes, she does, definitely. And she has a bookstore in Key West in which she, has a whole section of banned books. But what's great about this, I thought the casting was absolutely spot on. Abby Ryder Fortson plays Margaret about as well as anyone could ever imagine. She's more kind of multifaceted than she is on the page. And she's curious. She's open-hearted. She's funny. She's smart. And on top of it, she's thoroughly believable. There's nothing like precocious about her. The story doesn't mock her in any way. It treats her like a fully fledged adolescent. And she's, of course, coming to terms with her changing body and female rites of passage and all of that. The family has moved from New York City to suburban New Jersey. She's very close to her grandmother, who's played by Kathy Bates, in this very charming, vivacious way. And Rachel McAdams, as her mom, is just perfect. She's this artistic woman who has to move to the suburbs and isn't quite comfortable with it. And one of the things I loved about this, in addition to looking at the sort of coming of age of a 11-year-old, it looks at sort of the awkwardness of maybe reaching middle age in the suburbs for somebody who was more of a city person, and that's Rachel McAdams' character. And it looks at, this woman who's vivacious and in her 60s, and she's coming to terms with her older age and where that puts her. So it really, there's more complexity here than there was in the book, and it's just done really well. She, the director had done The Edge of 17, which also looks at sort of a teenage exploration of sex in high school, and I think she was ideally suited to adapt this.
The director and the adapter is Kelly Freeman Craig. The film is Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret Wade.
As the father of a 10-year-old girl, this was the most terrifying film I have seen since The Shining. But that's a good thing, because, I'm not familiar with the book, never read the book. I grew up in the 70s, but, I'm a boy. So this is sort of, opening your eyes to a completely different perspective, especially a perspective that took place when I was growing up as well. And I think it's just an absolutely wonderful film. It's absolutely wonderful. And it makes sense that it's better than the book because it's made with the advantage of hindsight.
Yeah.
The book was written in its moment. This can look back and it can put that kind of nostalgic veneer on it, which enables you to look at the past in a more meaningful way to the present. And I think it's a very smart script. I mean, Kelly Freeman Craig has done a wonderful job. I'm glad they didn't have someone else write it and her direct it. She sees this through creatively, beginning to end. It's her vision. It's her interpretation. There's no meddling in it. Lionsgate, you know, behind this, not a studio that would have added 14 other layers of development meddling. And the casting is perfect. No meddling there. She cast the right actresses. There's no, let's get somebody who's on this TV show or that TV show or brings this currency. None of those compromises. It's a complete artistic effort for this director, this writer-director, and you feel it. You connect to it emotionally on every level. I'm a middle-aged man, and I was completely connected to these adolescent girls and their experiences. And that says a lot. This is a beautiful crossover film. And there's a test as to only the handful of films that pass it.
The Bechdel test.
The Bechdel test.
Yeah.
Very few films pass that.
Yeah.
This one passes it.
Which is? What is the test measure?
It has to have female lead characters who aren't defined by their connections to men.
Yes.
Things like that. And they have to have a certain amount of dialogue or presence
with
in the
other
film,
women and
with
not
other
a,
women.
About
yes.
men with men. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this passes it.
Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, in wide release, the comedic drama written and directed by Kelly Freeman, adapted from Judy Blume's book. It's rated PG-13. The sports biopic, Big George Foreman, the miraculous story of the once and future heavyweight champion of the world, is directed by George Tillman Jr., who co-wrote it with Frank Baldwin. It stars Chris Davis. Wait, what'd you think?
I am so glad to have George Tillman Jr. back in the saddle again. Ever since Soul Food, one of my favorite directors. He brings so much heart and soul and real emotional honesty to his films. And George Foreman's story is one that needs it because it's told in a perfect three-act structure and not the traditional kind of Sid Field three-act, but the three acts of George Foreman's life, which is this man born into poverty who becomes an Olympic champion and then world heavyweight champion, and then pivots, leaves it all behind, and becomes a minister, becomes a pastor, becomes a born-again preacher, and then comes back to boxing and becomes world champion at 45, which has never been accomplished before. It's three completely incredible chapters and acts in one of the most remarkable lives of our lifetime. And to their credit, they spent almost no time on the George Foreman grill because it's not really that important. It's a cute little throwaway
thing.
Made
him a lot
of
money, apparently.
Made him a ton of money. But it's emblematic of this tenacity and this willingness to just go with whatever life throws him and to never let anyone else define him. And, you know, it's a little bit saccharine at times. It probably isn't quite perfectly balanced. It gives, you know, that last chapter, the comeback chapter, probably could have come a little bit earlier and given a little more attention. You can quibble with things like that. But you're watching this movie and you're just thinking, this is really a beautiful story. And you're with it every step of the way. And Forrest Whitaker as, you know, the coach who made him and stuck with him the whole time and now in the Boxing Hall of Fame is just wonderful. Also brings just so much heart and soul to this film. So, I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful, good traditional Hollywood biopic in all the best ways.
George Foreman, one of my favorite interviews over the years of Air Talk. I just love talking with him. Very transparent and open about his life and the things that he was very regretful about, very open about his failings as a person.
And he's an executive
well.
Producer on this, and there are no rose-colored glasses. I mean, his failings are a big part of the film.
Yeah, I really appreciated talking with him. Big George Foreman, the miraculous story of the once and future heavyweight champion of the world, rated PG-13. It's in wide release. The Romanian drama RMN, which essentially are the initials of a scanning machine like an MRI in Romanian, is written and directed by Christian Munju. Claudia, please start us on RMN.
I really like this film. Christian Munju did the wonderful film 4 Months, 3 Weeks, and 2 Days, and he got the Palme d'Or for that. This was also at the Cannes Film Festival. It's a really fascinating film about insularity, about cultural divisions, about xenophobia, most of all. And while it takes place in a very small town in Transylvania, and no, there's no vampires or anything. Mm-hmm. Think Transylvania,
it is a real place.
It's
yes.
a real place. And it's interesting because at times it looks really horrible and barren. Other times it looks quite beautiful. But anyway, this is it takes place in Transylvania. But it explores the kind of fear and loathing of immigrants and outsiders that is happening all over the world today. So it feels very germane. It feels very timely. It's an indictment of racism and closed-mindedness. And it's, you know, sort of focused on this insular community as it's dealing with immigration, both immigration and emigration, because there are people, a smaller group of people coming from other countries there because they aren't paying enough for the local people who are leaving to go to Germany or various other places. So all of that is the backdrop. And that's really the story. But we're following this guy, Matthias, who is kind of a lunk. He's terse and he's kind of a... Yeah, he leaves his job in Germany at a slaughterhouse. And so at the very beginning, you're seeing a slaughterhouse, which is quite not a great thing to watch. But he comes back to this little Transylvanian village. He wants to reconnect with his son, who's been traumatized. He saw something that he has made him stop speaking. So there's a lot of interrelationships. He wants to reconnect with his former lover, who is inexplicably drawn to him because she's educated and cultured and he's this brutish, horrible guy. Mm-hmm. I will never understand that one. But and they hire a few new workers at the bakery that this woman, the object of his stalking, that she runs. And they hire them from Sri Lanka. And the community turns against them, basically. So it starts slowly. It takes a while for it to take off, and you're not really grasping what it's about yet. And then once it does, it's fascinating, and it's a slow burn, and it feels urgent. I thought until the end was a little ambiguous, and it left me wondering. It didn't take away from the rest of the film, but it's done in this very naturalistic way. There's this great community meeting where these xenophobic townsfolk get very heated about the immigrants that are there. It goes on for, it's like a long scene that goes on for close to 20 minutes. It's powerful. I liked it.
We're talking about the Romanian film RMN, which is in Romanian with English subtitles. Wade.
Yeah, it's interesting how universal so many of these ideas are. The ethnicities and the nationalities, they change. It reminds me when I was, years ago when I was in Budapest and they were all complaining about Ukrainians. And, you can change the names. And you can, but it's the dynamics are the same, and it's
the outsider.
And it's the outsider, yeah. The element here that I found to be much more illuminating, and I have a real love hate relationship with Romanian films, but I love Christian Mungiu. I love 4-3-2, as we call it in the critical community. But is that it's also very much about Romania in a moment of transition, and it's facing. Tremendous headwinds on economic growth all over. And that aspect of it, that this isn't just an insular community that's dealing with outsiders and immigration. It's a community that in many respects is trapped in the past. And how is it going to move into the future? It looks as if it probably looked 150 years ago. It hasn't really changed. People in their donkeys and, you have that question as well. How do these communities transform themselves when everyone is leaving and the people who are coming likely aren't going to be there permanently? And so there are all of these are questions, and they're not really resolved. I think that may be partly your issue with the ambiguity of the end, is that, Mungiu kind of, he takes you with this slow burn, and then he sort of throws his hands up in the end and goes, I don't have an answer. And
well, there is no answer. And that wasn't it. It was more sort of how it went off in a slightly ghostly way.
Yeah. But it's a Romanian film, and we cut them a lot of slack for doing experimental things that nobody else does. And he's such a talented filmmaker, and the performances are so strong. So I think it's really top notch.
We're talking about the film from writer director Christian Mungiu, RMN. The Romanian drama is in wide release. Let's at least briefly get started. If we can't finish on Sisu, which is a Finnish war film, Wade.
This is the most insane movie. I've seen a lot of Neo Tarantino knockoffs. Most of them, they're kind of sad. This one is amazing, and I have to believe that if Quentin Tarantino saw this film, assuming he hasn't seen it yet, he will love it on a level that is incomprehensible. This is basically a remake of A Fistful of Dollars, except that instead of Mexicans, you have Nazis. Instead of Clint Eastwood, you have this crazy Romanian prospector with a history. Or sorry, this crazy Finnish prospector. Still stuck on Romania.
I was like, Romanian?
Yeah, no, this crazy Finnish prospector. And it all takes place in the Lapland part of Finland in the closing days of World War II. So basically, this old guy finds a whole lot of gold, thinks he's got it made, packs it onto his horse, is trapped by some Nazis on the road. They take his gold, and man, do they regret it.
All right. Sisu is the film from Finland. It's written and directed by Jalmari Helander. It's rated R and in wide release. We have much more to come on Film Week. Our critics joining us this week are Wade Major and Claudia Puig. We'll be back in just 1 minute.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting an evening in focus, Goya. The museum's galleries come to life at this interactive event, celebrating the opening of the exhibition, I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. Enjoy live music, art-making activities for all ages, live model drawing, tours, and more. Free with museum admission. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. Larry Mantle with Claudia Puig and Wade Major. Wade was just telling us about the Finnish movie Sisu, which is in both English and Finnish in wide release. Wade, just a final note on Sisu.
Yeah, people should know it's a Finnish film, but it's almost entirely in English. Okay. And the level of violence is so off the chart. It's really quite a ride.
All right. It is rated R in wide release. The French comedic drama, The Romance Other People's Children, written and directed by Rebecca Zlotowski. Claudia.
I love this film. I first saw it last September at TIFF and was determined to program it for Santa Barbara. We did, and it was a festival favorite. I love how the writer-director looks at it, kind of forming a bond with children, motherhood, if you want to call it that in a very broad way, from a fresh perspective. It's sort of outside the traditional biological sense. And I love the lead actress is just such a luminous presence, Virginie Efira. She's so nuanced, and the film is really, she's just so fully drawn. There's so much honesty here. It looks into the ways that people can foster substantive and gratifying bonds with children outside of the parental role. It looks at the human ability to nurture young people, and it's all done with a light touch. And yet there's a lot of full spectrum of emotions here. I just found it to be really an excellent film. The little girl who, a four-year-old daughter of... She's so cute.
Oh.
Yeah, Layla. Her, the actress is Callie Ferreira Gonsalves. She's just this wonderful
Unreal.
Little actress. Yeah, and she's a real kid. She covers the gamut from like adorable
so
to unruly to everything in between. And I really love this. Is a woman who connects with, she has a relationship with this man, and the man's daughter. And
which I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that experience. And so if the relationship doesn't make it, there's more at stake than just the person who's your boyfriend or
girlfriend.
Exactly.
And it explores all of that. And also how she's able to help one of her students who's in trouble. And so it's really about other people's children. It's a perfect title.
That's the title of the film, Wade.
I have to give Claudia all the credit for making me watch this because, you know, it was kind of between a few other films. And this is just so wonderful. Thank God for the French. This is the kind of French filmmaking I grew up on and that I just love. It's beautiful. No car chases, explosions, guns, nothing. It's just people. It's human relationships. And these wonderful series of emotional dilemmas that everyone connects to. Whether or not you're a parent, whether or not you're in these situations, they're so real. The performances are wonderful. Virginie Efira, the Belgian actress who stars in this, does so much with so little. It's when she's not saying anything, when she's reacting to Layla, when she's reacting to Layla's mother, played by Chiara Mastroianni. And they have a really interesting relationship in this as well. You know, all of the little moments where it's just the eyes, the mouth, the body language, and your heart sinks and your heart soars. It's shot in scope with long lenses. I mean, all these choices, these really interesting stylistic choices, great French music from years ago. Julien Clerc comes up on the soundtrack and I just swooned. It was fantastic. I love everything about this movie.
Wow, raves for Other People's Children. The film written and directed by Rebecca Zlotowski. It's unrated. It's in French and Hebrew with English subtitles. And you can see it at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. The Disney Plus streaming action fantasy adventure Peter Pan and Wendy's, directed by David Lowry, who co-wrote it with Toby Halbrooks. It's, of course, based on the play from J.M. Barrie Wade.
Oh, gosh. This is such a wreck.
That doesn't sound good.
No, it's not. And I do love David Lowry. I think David Lowry is a wonderful director. And this is really stylish and nicely made. The problem is that we've had so many Peter Pan movies over so many years, starting with Hook, and then, you know, we had P.J. Hogan's Peter Pan in 2003, which was not Disney adjacent. That was just straight from the book. But still, you know, it's all part of the canon.
The animated original one.
The animated original
one. Which is good.
And you have a problem here, which is it's fan service to the Disney canon. You have to make it connect to all the Disney stuff, but then they have to be a little self-referential because they're talking about Peter Pan, the book, in the movie, and really Peter Pan's real. And then it deviates into this weird story detour where we have to somehow redeem Captain Hook with a backstory. And it's too much. And there's too much corporate constraining on this film, that it has to do this, but it can't do that. And so you feel it buckling under the pressure of that, and the fact that we're now comparing all these characters and all these actors to the ones who played these parts in those other movies. You know, I mean, nobody did Hook like Dustin Hoffman. Sorry. And, you know, we're now on our third Tinkerbell, and we're on our third Smee, and, you know, Jim Gaffigan is playing Smee, and is he really a great Smee? And I don't think we've ever had a good... I mean, the flaw in P.J. Hogan's film was Peter Pan wasn't strong. And it's the same problem here. This actor, he's British at least, and he's a little better, but he's still not right. You know, we're still comparing him to the Peter Pan in the animated film. Who's our Peter Pan? And so all of this stuff, I think it's time to just cut this franchise loose and let us live with our memories. And
come back
and
30 years
and we're done with it. I think we've done Peter Pan today.
Peter Pan and Wendy, David Lowry, the director and co-screenwriter, rated PG, streaming on Disney Plus. The British action comedy Polite Society stars Priya Kansara and Ritu Arya. The film's written and directed by Nida Manzoor. Claudia, what'd you think of Polite Society?
I found it quite entertaining. It's a fusion of British wit, kung fu action movie scenes, and Bollywood.
There it is. That's it. There it is.
So if you like any one of those, you know, and there's a bit of horror thrown in too. Yes.
Right.
It's a mashup of genres, as, you know, stated, and it's this very sweet celebration of sisterhood. And the quest to realize your dream despite parental disapproval. And the lead actress, Priya Kansara, is really good. She's this teenage martial artist who wants to be a stunt person. She wants to save her older sister from what she thinks is going to be a disastrous marriage, and utilizes her martial arts skills and pulls off a wedding heist. It's very entertaining.
Yeah, Wade, what did you think?
Claudia liked it more than I did. I love all three of those things. Yeah. I love a good British comedy. I love Bollywood. I love kung fu movies. Pack them all into one. It's like jack of all trades, master of none. I just didn't know what to make of this movie. I'm not a fan of mashups at this level. And, I mean, I can see what people would enjoy in it. I can appreciate that, but it kind of left me a little
cold. It had some Edgar Wright qualities, I thought.
Yeah, I could see some of that. Yeah, I never got in the groove. I never kind of found what they were looking for.
Polite Society, the film from writer-director Nida Manzoor. It's rated PG-13 and in wide release. Freaks versus the Reich, also with an alternate title of Freaks Out, is a fantasy war film directed by Gabriella Manetti. What did you think, Wade, of Freaks versus the Reich?
Yeah, Manetti's second film. So if Federico Fellini were hired to direct The Inglourious Basterds as X-Men in a World War II era Italian Wizard of Oz allegory.
Okay, there's a mashup.
This would be the movie.
What a week.
I'm not sure that's a good thing. At 2 hours and 20 minutes, it really overstays its welcome. It's a massively ambitious film. It's so ambitious that it winds up being self-defeating. I think that's part of the problem. There can be too much ambition, and you can try too hard. And this film tries too hard. I mean, the quartet of circus freaks with special powers who are, you know, again fighting the Nazis, trying to rescue their Jewish boss who's been taken away by the Nazis, and at the same time, the Nazi that they're fighting the most has six fingers and he can see the future, and he has superpowers too. So there's this weird X-Men-y thing going on, and it knows it, and it kind of winks at you with some Marvel references, and it winds up being too cute and too clever and too ambitious by more than half. It's kind of an audition film. It's, you know, saying, give me a Hollywood assignment, please. And maybe that'll work, but as a piece of entertainment, it really overstays its welcome.
And it's set in Italy, or
it's set in Italy when the Nazis, about 1943, when the Nazis move into Italy to try to keep it in the coalition, and they occupy Rome. That's when all hell breaks loose.
Freaks versus the Reich is unrated. It's in Italian with English subtitles. You can see it at Lemley's Glendale Theater, and it's available on demand. The Fabric of the Human Body is the English translation of De Humani Corporis Fabrica, which is a documentary film deploying custom-made cameras to look, is it inside the body,
yep.
Claudia?
Yep, yep,
just
yep.
as it sounds?
Just as repulsive right. and as fascinating as it
yeah.
sounds. yes, the human body's opened up for our examination and yes, for our revulsion in some ways too, but the camera reveals and inspects the human body and offers this endlessly fascinating, unsettling, and really massively immersive landscape. As I was watching it, I was thinking, your body is a wonderland, but that's not the context that John Mayer thought, but it really is a fascinating. The bodies are really interesting. And it's done in this fly-on-the-wall style, and there's no narration, there's no explanations, there's no, you know, you don't know what part of the body you're looking at a lot of the times. We at the LA Film Critics gave it our Experimental Film Award this year. And so you see all these body parts and innards and entrails and all kinds of things, and you're trying to guess. And so you see, like, magnified eyes being sliced, and it's unclear for what purpose. And maybe cataracts, maybe a lens transplant. You see brains being poked and prodded and surgerized. And the filmmakers use these microscopic cameras. They travel through veins and arteries. And then the audio is this casual conversation because they're just basically in several hospitals in France. And they're just, it's a conversation of the doctors and the nurses and the other medical workers, just, you know, about parking or about, you know, well, the most, nothing to do with them.
As you're seeing an eye slit
yes.
open.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, you see people who are on the brink of death. We actually do see a corpse whose socks are being put on, and then the women, these cheerful women who are, they put his underwear on backwards, dressing him back up for, I guess, to put him in the morgue. At one point, the surgeon complains about some muscles deteriorating in his arm, and someone says, you're going to get surgery? And he's like, are you kidding? And that's how you feel. You walk out of this going, may I never be in a hospital. However, you also walk away, you know, really impressed by the wonders of medicine. And this was done around the early 2000s. And I have to think that some of the tugging and slicing and dicing would now be done more meticulously with lasers and things like that. But I found it fascinating. But off-putting.
We're talking about the documentary De Humani Corporis Fabrica, or The Fabric of the Human Body. It's in French with English subtitles. You can see the documentary at Lemley's Glendale in Glendale. The mystery thriller Snag is directed by Ben Milliken, who co-wrote the film and stars in it as well. Wade, what'd you think of Snag?
funny, it's another Neo Tarantino knockoff with deep spaghetti Western credentials on it. Ben Milliken, some people might know from Bosch. He was on Bosch for a little bit on TV. He's an Anglo-Australian actor-director and very charming and very, very entertaining, as, you know, in the way that he casts himself here. He's basically a drug mule in Mexico who it looks like just kind of a sweet, slackery guy, but turns out he's just unkillable. You just can't kill him. He's ruthless in kind of a dopey way. He fights. He doesn't die. He's relentless. And if you get on his wrong side, you know, that's not where you want to be. But there's somebody more lethal, which is the woman who is the mother of the girl he falls in love with. He falls in love with a Mexican girl whose mom is a drug kingpin, and she does not want this loser with her daughter. So the film is now structured with the lovers on the run angle, and then there's what happened after that. And it keeps flashing back then and now, then and now. And it's a little confusing. It's a little too cute. It's not as clever as, you know, some of the other films that try to do this. It has a true romance kind of vibe to it a little bit. It's entertaining. It's not brilliant. But despite my misgivings, I kind of stuck with it. And I wound up, even though the end makes no sense at all, it's not satisfying, I did enjoy the relationship.
Who does Jaime Camille from Jane the Virgin. Who does he play?
Boy, that's Jaime Camille.
I just thought he's listed there. But.
Yeah, I don't know the actors.
Because he's such a good comic actor, but
It's a good cast. It's a good cast. Whatever part he plays, he's good in it. Because there's no one in it who's bad.
Snag is the film. It's rated R in select theaters and available on demand. Claudia, we're almost out of time. Can you give us about 30 seconds, maybe appropriately, on the end of Sex?
Yes, it doesn't deserve much more. Emily Hampshire, who played Stevie in Schitt's Creek, is like the most recognizable face. And then also Colin Mochrie from Whose Line Is It Anyway? It has its moments. It's really hard to make a consistently good comedy. We all know that. This one is uneven. It's not very original. There's some silly hijinks. There is one funny scene where they go to this sex club and run into people they don't want to run into there. You know, I saw this played at TIFF, of all things, and it's really not of the caliber Toronto Film Festival. I keep telling filmmakers this, that, you know, if you make even just a decent comedy, you'll probably get into a film festival, because very few comedies are ever submitted to film festivals. And this is a good example of kind of a mediocre one, but, you know, with some laughs.
It's a Canadian film, by the way, the romantic comedy The End of Sex, starring Emily Hampshire and Jonas Chernick. Sean Garrity, the director, Jonas Chernick, who's in the cast, wrote the screenplay. It's rated R, and you can see it in select theaters. Coming up, we'll be talking with our John Horn. He'll be with us to talk about what he experienced at CinemaCon at Caesars Palace in Las Vegas. Movie theater owners feeling a bit more hopeful now. We'll find out the reasons why when we hear from John coming up in just 1 minute.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting an evening in focus, Goya. The museum's galleries come to life at this interactive event, celebrating the opening of the exhibition, I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. Enjoy live music, art-making activities for all ages, live model drawing, tours, and more, free with museum admission. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Support comes from Japan House LA, presenting Yes, Kawaii is Art. Express yourself. Kawaii translates to cute or adorable, yet its influence extends beyond aesthetics to encompass fashion, art, technology, and even social behavior. Sebastian Masuda, the king of kawaii, brings together multiple artworks unraveling the kawaii concepts to foster a sense of joy, innocence, and community as a tool for self-expression and representation. Visitors can step into this colorful world to feel the aesthetic for themselves. May 2nd to November 3rd. No admissions fee. More at japanhousela.com.
Welcome back to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. In the late 1970s, movie theater owners started gathering every year. The event's now called CinemaCon. The annual convention ran from Monday to Thursday this past week in Las Vegas. CinemaCon's the largest gathering for the theater industries. There are attendees from more than 80 countries watching scores of previews of upcoming big studio movies. LAist arts and entertainment reporter John Horn traveled to the event. He sat down down with John Fithian, the outgoing president and CEO of the National Association of Theater Owners. They talked about the streaming wars and its impact on the multiplex, what distribution models make the most money, and the relevance of art house movies in this blockbuster world.
In the last few months, something interesting has happened, and you can categorize it however you want to do it. But Amazon had a film called Air that, according to some funny people, was too good to stream, and they put it in theaters. It did pretty good business. Netflix had a movie called Glass Onion, the Knives Out sequel, that they put in theaters for only a week, I guess, to say to everybody else, this movie's so good, we're going to give it to theaters, but you got to come to Netflix if you really want to watch it, unless you don't show up. And taken together, what do they show you about the evolving relationship between the theatrical business and streaming platforms?
You've identified probably the most significant development of this week. The streaming wars that started pre-pandemic, because streaming services were spending so much money buying up the best talent in town to go make movies and television shows for them that we lost temporarily some of the best filmmakers for theatrical movies. During the pandemic, of course, the release models changed dramatically. A lot of movies went straight to streaming services. A lot of movies were released simultaneously to theaters and streaming services. And some movies were released theatrically with a window, as they had been traditionally. And so everyone got to see a whole bunch of data. What does it mean when you release a movie first in a theater, wait a while, and then go to the home? What does it mean when you do it at the same time? And what does it mean when you only send the movie to the home? And the data is extraordinarily clear now that the best business model for everybody is the first. In other words, you release a movie in cinemas, it has an exclusive period, you have a decent marketing campaign, it gets really well known, it makes a bunch of money in the cinema, and then when it pops on the streaming service later, it does even better on the streaming service than it would have done had it gone straight there.
Speaking of data, the per capita admission numbers, according to the Motion Picture Association, 10 years ago, the average moviegoer in North America, US and Canada, went to the movies four times a year. Before the pandemic hit, that number was declining. It's now at two. Can that number ever get back to four, or is that the world theater owners have to accept as the new world?
Neither, potentially. The fact that theater admissions are now at two is in large measure a reflection of the fact that there haven't been enough movies in the marketplace to get people out of their homes more often.
But it was declining in 2019.
I said neither, right? So hold on. So it's not going to stick at two forever, right? As the number of movies come back and the diversity of movies appealing to all genre, all demographics comes back, so too will theater attendance numbers and box office numbers. But the other thing I would say is that we're already making as much or more on a per movie basis than we made before the pandemic.
Can a business survive that has lost one out of every three customers? It's dollar figures.
It's a third for now because we're still missing a third of the movies. So the real question you're driving at is attendance the key factor? And I would say attendance is an important factor, but it's not the key factor. If you're in a for-profit business, the key factor is gross revenues, right?
Let's talk about income inequality at the box office. In 2019, the top 10 movies for the year accounted for about 30-some-odd% of all tickets sold. Last year, it was about 70%. And there are plenty of movies that I can name off the top of my head that were good movies that nobody saw. Tar, She Said, Women Talking, Till, the list goes on. You can say Everything Everywhere is the outlier, but that's the exception to that rule. It feels like there's no middle and very little bottom now, that it's all hits all the time. And I don't know if that's a consequence of there not being as many titles or that audiences now say we'll come out for the Super Bowl, but we're not going to watch the playoff game.
Remember that both production and exhibition were seriously stopped and then massively delayed by the pandemic. And as movie makers ramped back up their movie production, what do you think they started with? Big, huge blockbusters that can make a lot of money fast for studios who are really, really desperate for revenues to come back. I would argue, though, John, with no offense to any of the movies that you just cited, those movies are all Oscar bait. Not a whole lot of people want to watch an Academy Award show where Tar's nominated. That's an intense art film designed for a very small audience and also designed for awards contention.
You're describing Black Swan as well, which grossed $170 million. So I hear you. I hear you.
Yeah.
But if I am a studio executive and I see that the older 60 and older filmmakers aren't coming back to the same numbers that other moviegoers are, and I look at those films, my concern would be that they would say, that doesn't work, and we're going to stop making those
movies.
But wait,
your premise on the older demographic not coming back is wrong. Your premise that small budget and mid-budget films may be more challenged now than pre-pandemic has some validity to it. I'm just not saying it's as big of a crisis as you think it is, but I will emphatically challenge the mid-pandemic reality, post-pandemic myth of two demographics. One is that seniors don't want to come back to the movies, and one is that families with young children don't want to come back to the movies. Look what happened with Super Mario, okay? And by the same token, if you look at the demographics on movies like Elvis or Top Gun or 80s for Brady or a whole number of movies where the senior demographic skewed very, very high on those types of movies compared to what they would have been even pre-pandemic. So I do not believe it's the case that seniors and families are not coming back to the cinema. I just think they haven't had enough content that appeals to them.
If you want to see a movie, you have a choice of maybe 12. If you're in a smaller market, maybe 6. You're going to have to see it at a certain time on a certain night, and you're going to have to drive to get there. Is there any way that model can evolve? Because it hasn't changed in a century.
The theatrical model hasn't changed in a century. Provocative, but wrong. You're citing elements of the model that have not changed and ignoring massive improvements in the experience that have
changed.
But
we're not talking about seats, recliners, food. I'm talking about...
Well, of course you are.
I'm talking about when you can see a movie.
So let me back up first and tell you what has changed in the model, okay? Premium large formats, immersive sound systems, luxury recliner chairs, food and beverage service at all levels of low end to high end. My wife picks her theater based on where the best Cabernet is. Yes, we need to continue to refurbish and upgrade, but we have made all these technological and experiential achievements in the cinema without raising the ticket prices faster than the cost of inflation. Because it's still the case that tickets today, compared to tickets in the 1970s, are slightly less than what they would have been with the cost of inflation.
No argument.
So all that improvement in the experience, I think, contradicts soundly that the model of the experience in theaters hasn't changed for 100 years. Your only point is watch the movie when you want to watch the movie.
That is what
here's,
is important.
Here's
I've got
the difference.
Two kids. That's all kids care about. When can I watch
it's
it
not,
and where can I watch it?
It's not, and here's why.
Your kids are different than
okay.
mine.
here's why the when can I watch it is not an issue. When you go out to a restaurant, when you go out to a movie theater, when you go out to a sporting event, when you go out to, you name it, laser tag, I don't care what it is, it's a decision to have an event experience. And therefore, you pick the time you want to go. And you go online and you look at all the screen times and all the locations. And there are many, many, many choices in the time in which you see it. But you do have to go out at the time you picked. But that's okay. It's an event experience. It's not the same thing as the home. The last thing I'll say about your multiplicity of ways to watch movies in the home, which is actually correct, is that the research shows that the more sophisticated devices people have in the home to watch movies and television shows, the more they go out to the movies. Because movie lovers are movie lovers.
John, it's been great talking with you.
All right.
Thanks again,
John,
for your time.
When we come back, John Horn speaks with a small town theater owner about how popcorn paid the mortgage through the pandemic. We'll be back. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. Our John Horn attended CinemaCon in Las Vegas this past week. It's the annual gathering of movie theater owners. They see studio previews and talk about their business. John sat down with a handful of theater owners, one of them being Stephen Shopes, who runs a single two-screen theater in Seminole, Oklahoma.
Tell me about Seminole. How many people live there, and what's the town like?
Seminole currently is about 7,800 people. Seminole was the home of the biggest oil strike in the United States in the 20s, and I think 10% of all the oil in the world was produced in Seminole that year, and Seminole grew to over 100,000 people in the late 1920s.
So tell me how you came to own a movie theater.
What happened was I was retired out of the hospital business, and it was rumored that the theater was being sold or was on the block to be sold, the local theater, to someone who was going to turn it into a dollar discount house, which if you're in economic development in small towns, when you lose your movie theater or it gets demoted to a, from a first-run theater to a dollar cinema in those days, that's the kiss of death for a town. So I went to him, and I made an offer, which I thought was ridiculously low. And by that night, I owned a movie theater.
Well, I guess he was eager to sell. Before that, had you been a movie fan? Did you go to that theater beforehand? Tell me about your love of movies.
We have always been movie people. We've many times on birthdays or anniversaries, we will go to one or two or maybe three movies in one day and make it a full day and go to dinner in between. So we were movie people from the beginning.
Now, I've covered Hollywood a long time, and whenever somebody who might have a little money is asked about investing in the movie business, smart people say, be prepared to lose everything. Is owning a movie theater a business? Are the margins good? Are you able to make a living on running a theater?
I've told people for years that if you're looking to retire wealthy and have a family of four, this isn't the business for you. You have to love the business. It does make money. There's no question about it. If it's run correctly, it makes money. You have to be able to withstand the cyclical nature of movie business. Maybe not in the big cities, but in the rural areas especially, we live and breathe based on the public school schedule. When public schools let out, we get busy. When public schools are in session, we aren't busy. And then again, you have seasonal changes. For example, spring break is a big movie time. And then there's nothing really until Memorial Day weekend. From Memorial Day weekend, it goes all the way through Labor Day. Between Labor Day and Thanksgiving, there's not much. And then from Thanksgiving to first week in January, it's fairly busy and sometimes really busy, depending on what movies there are. And then in January to March, it's dead. Now, the movie studios have gotten a lot better about releasing movies throughout the calendar now, and that has helped a lot. But I can tell you that the movie business is all about the movies. Doesn't matter how good, and this is where I part with my friends in other exhibitors. If the movies are not good, it doesn't matter what the theater does, you can't get people to come to movies. People are not going to come to bad movies.
So you had the opportunity to testify in front of the U.S. House of Representatives.
You've done your research.
I have. That's my job. And I have in front of me your prepared remarks. That it was a committee on small business called State of the Small Business Economy in the Era of COVID-19, February 4th, 2021. I'm going to quote yourself back to you. You said, comparing our theater's 2019 revenues to the same period in 2020, we have seen a 92.5% reduction. We have been forced to reduce our staffing to almost nothing and have resorted to selling popcorn and concessions to go. How did you survive? How are you still in business today?
That's an interesting story. We first did sell popcorn to go. For a long time, we started by delivering it to people's houses because people would not come out even. We literally would.
Now, anything, when you say we, is this you and your wife?
My wife and I.
What kind of car are you driving here?
I had a Tesla.
Okay, so the Tesla popcorn guy pulls up and he's got a hot tub of buttered popcorn you're selling for $5?
No, we had these bags that were about 36 inches long that we filled with popcorn. They're popcorn bags. They're clear bags. And we would make these. And I'm telling you, at the high point, we made 40, 50 a day. And that's what we delivered. And we delivered, and it got, we had probably the first time we delivered 25 or 30 deliveries, which for a small town is a big deal. The problem became that we were exposing ourselves and we were exposing other people again to that. So we developed a drive-up system where you came up, you texted us, let us know you were in the parking lot, we had your order. Everything was touchless. We went through PayPal. We you could order online. It was we converted our movie website to a concessions to go website.
But that's a fraction of what you would make when you're selling tickets and everybody there is buying concessions. It's probably what maybe your 5% of your normal revenues or
so. Well, our key was to cover the mortgage.
Did you ever think that maybe you weren't going to make it?
No, I never did. I knew we were going to make it. Were we going to make it in the same form that we were in? I wasn't sure of that. We had a tremendous community support. We had people coming and, you know, you can, these giant bags of popcorn, you can eat so many of them and that's it. We had people buying them 2 and 3 times a week. And we asked them, what are you doing with all this popcorn? They said, we don't care about the popcorn. We want to make sure you guys survive. And we had so many people that came and said that. And we had people taking pictures when we delivered our popcorn to them originally. They would take pictures of it and post it on Facebook. So then it just started snowballing. And it was a lot of fun at first. It started out, you know, I hadn't worked that much concession in a long time. So I popped a lot of popcorn.
What role do you think the theater serves in being a place where your community comes together? I mean, obviously they were very generous in buying popcorn. They had no room to eat. But what does the theater mean in terms of the city and about a place where people come together?
A lot of the families, they trust that they can drop their children off at the movie theater and they're going to be okay. And so it's kind of like we're all a big family at times. And I know my customers, my wife and I know our customers as they come in. We talk to them about everything, anything and everything when they come through. Just last week I was stopped. Are you guys doing okay? I think we're still having those moments. We did have a lot of those moments when we opened up again after being closed for 9 months because I don't think it would have mattered what we showed. It packed the house. People wanted to get back. They wanted to make sure we were okay. Yes, we had decreased the number of people we allowed in the theater. We made them sit, you know, 6 feet apart and wear masks and do all those things. But still, they wanted to come back, and I think it made us feel very well loved in our community. I am very optimistic right now.
I really appreciate your coming in. I'm so glad I ran into you yesterday, so thanks for your time.
It's our John Horn talking with theater owner Stephen Shopes at CinemaCon in Las Vegas this past week. If you missed any part of their conversation or our critics' reviews, just go to LAist.com. You can listen to full episodes of Film Week anytime you want or download those episodes wherever you get your podcasts. From all of us at Film Week, have a wonderful weekend.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.